Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Whole Scoop. This is a health and wellness radio show where our guests are always highly credentialed in their fields. And the goal of this program is to present different and sometimes opposite perspectives to allow the listeners to make informed decisions about what might be the right health approach for them. I am your host, Carol Ferraci, a registered licensed dietitian who has practiced for over 30 years. I'm also the founder of Naturally Nutrition, and you can check me out at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. You know, as a healthcare practitioner, it's important for me to provide you highly qualified guests on a variety of topics in order to promote your own health and wellness. So tonight's show, we've taken a little bit of a different tune tonight. Tonight's show is your pet, your health, are they really that different? Please let me remind you that while our guests are highly credentialed on the topic of discussion, it is always recommended to seek medical advice prior to implementing any and all interventions discussed on this program. The call-in number is 347-855-8894. You can also direct questions and comments to www.blogtalkradio.com/thewholescoop. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and, of course, Blog Talk Radio. Again, the call-in number is 347-855-8894. We will be taking questions later on in the program. And at that point in time, I'll be calling out the last four digits of your telephone number. If you're calling in with a question, please remember to press the number 1 in order to become part of the queue for questions. I'm so excited about tonight because it is just a little different than what we normally do. And we've got a fabulous guest. We've kind of changed the format just a bit. We usually have two guests. Tonight we have one because I feel like this particular guest is so all-encompassing on pet health that we don't really need two people. So we have Dr. Constance Di Natale. She is a doctor of veterinary medicine who graduated from the University of Florida, the School of Medicine, in 1992. And while in veterinary school, she became certified in veterinary acupuncture through the International Veterinary Acupuncture Society. In 1999, she completed her certification in veterinary chiropractic and opened practice in Florida. Dr. Di Natale is a professor at the Qi Institute in Redick, Florida, where she teaches acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine to veterinarians. A much sought-after speaker, Dr. Di Natale lectures around the country and internationally at veterinary conferences on acupuncture, herbs, and food therapy. She enjoys spending her spare time with her son Valentine and her three dogs, Jordy, Sophie, and Bailey. And I like I said, we are just so very fortunate to have her tonight. Dr. Di Natale, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much, Carol.
Hi. Thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited.
My pleasure.
We have so many things that we can talk about, and I chose the name of this show for a reason. Your pet, your health, are they really that different? I think we can probably get into a whole lot of stuff about that. But I think at first, why don't you just kind of give us an overview of the types of patients that you see in your practice?
Well, you know, I am a regular veterinarian and got my veterinary degree. And then after veterinary school, I went on and got a lot of training in different holistic modalities. So I practice acupuncture. I practice spinal manipulation because we're not allowed as veterinarians to say chiropractic because that's considered something you do on humans. So we got the type of training chiropractors had for animals, except that we call it spinal manipulation. I'm trained in Chinese herbs, Western herbs, you know, and I've gotten a lot of different backgrounds. So the practice I have now, we actually require that our clients have regular veterinarians to do, like, day-to-day things and surgeries and x-rays and things like that. And then at our practice, we see patients that have chronic disease, maybe sometimes terminal diseases. We do musculoskeletal problems, we do a lot of geriatric medicine, and we do preventative-type medicine. We do a lot of agility dogs that either get injured or people just want to keep them in good shape. So we kind of have a wide range of different clientele, although I do think, you know, for me, my favorite part of my practice and a big part of my practice is the geriatric medicine.
Okay. And when you say geriatric medicine, you're talking about from what age? I mean, because dogs and cats, is it true that they age differently than we do? And what constitutes geriatric in that perspective?
Well, for me, geriatric, I consider a dog geriatric when it's about 12 years old and older. And I expect the cat would start to show geriatric problems when it's old and older. And much against what people often say, dogs don't age 7 years for, you know, it's not like 7 human years for every one dog here. Dogs, by the time they're 1 year old, a lot of dogs actually are more like probably a 15-year-old because they've already gone into their first heat. If it's a female, they're able to breed if they're a male. So you're actually not at 7 years old at the end of that first year. And by the end of your second year, you're probably in your early 20s. And then depending on the breed of the dog and how old you'd expect that breed to live, then, you know, each year after that kind of gets a little shorter and shorter how many years it would be. So, you know, by the time most dogs are probably 8 or 9 years old, that's kind of more like somebody in their 40s, maybe, you know, 40s, early 50s.
Okay. Well,
and
thank
cats,
you for that.
Cats longer. You know, cats live
longer
typically. So typically, yeah, because they tend to live a little longer. But the same thing, that first year is more like, you know, probably 16 years for that first year, you know, between 15, 16 years.
Wow. I don't think I ever realized that. I kind of was like everyone else going the whole seven-year thing, for each year. And but that actually makes sense when you put it into perspective of dogs being able to breed and cats being able to breed at 1 year. And, that actually does make a whole lot of sense. I thank you for that. I didn't get that at first.
Right, and even mentally, if you look at a dog who's 1 year old, they're still kind of juvenile, but they have a lot under their belt by then. And that's kind of like mm-hmm. a 15, 16-year-old. They think they know everything and, you know,
yeah.
But they're not a baby. They're not a baby anymore.
Right. Wow. It's funny that you use the analogy of the 15, 16-year-old because, again, if we go back to the name of the show, Your Pet, Your Health, are they really that different? There are a lot of similarities between what we see with humans versus animals in terms of their behaviors at different ages. And so how does that influence what you do with – because I'm assuming in your particular practice that you have a good, solid relationship with the owner as well as the pet, so I'm sure you see some of those similarities.
Yeah, we see that some problems that owners have also then their dogs will have as well. But, you know, what's interesting is that just like in humans, by the time you're 15 years old, you usually don't have a lot of chronic inflammation. You usually don't have a lot of problems. And just like in humans, the worse your diet is, the more you're putting in a lot of refined foods, a lot of processed foods, a lot of excess carbohydrates, improper diets, you're going to start showing up as inflammation, you know, because of that. And a dog who's sometimes now actually quite young, it used to be the dogs didn't show inflammatory signs until they were, you know, about 10, 11, 12 years old. Now we have dogs coming in that are 3, 4, 5 years old, and they've already got inflammation going on because their diet's not so good. And I think this is the same in humans that, you know, when there's a decent diet, at 15 years old, you shouldn't have a lot of inflammation, but you see more and more people in their 20s, 30s that are starting to have, you know, connective tissue tears and musculoskeletal problems and, you know, heel spurs and shin spurs and different kinds of inflammatory diseases. And a lot of it could be based on the fact that their diet's not so good. They tend to eat a lot of processed food, a lot of inflammatory foods. And so, you know, even the very best commercial holistic food is still very highly processed, still very high in carbohydrates. So yeah, I think we kind of mimic the owners in that way that, you know, diet definitely shows off in your body.
You know, it's interesting, too, another parallel just for me being a practitioner. you know, we're seeing a whole lot of adult onset diabetes in kids now. And that kind of falls right in line with what you just said as it relates to the animals. And we do. We mimic each other. You know, if I've seen it over and over again. And honestly, I've been guilty of it myself at times where, you know, if I'm eating something, then I share it. And it may not be the most healthiest thing in the world. So, you know, there's that component as well. And as you just said, even what should someone look for or look at in terms of determining what's a healthy food for their pet? And as far as low carbohydrate, you know, what constitutes low carbohydrate for an animal?
Animals have minimum requirements for protein that has to be met in commercial dog food. And so, but that's the minimum amount of protein that needs to be in the diet. So if you look, AFCO, AAFCO, has a whole set of guidelines that manufacturers of dog food must follow in order to have an AFCO-certified dog food. Most dog foods that you find at the store are AFCO-certified, and what that means is they've met the minimum amount of vitamins needed for a laboratory animal, not really a laboratory animal, but a research dog who has had this food tested on them, that they can, you know, grow up and maintain their body weight on this food and not have any severe deficiencies. So all foods are supposed to have that. A lot of the raw diets that are out nowadays do not have AFCO certification. So if you're trying to find a complete dog food, you should look on the package and make sure it says AFCO certified. If it does not say that, then that means that there's a good chance that the nutrition of that food is not being met by the manufacturer and that you would need to supplement that food to get the rest of what you want. Then another thing to look at for a good food is that you want to make sure that there's no semblance of sugar anywhere. So I had a client that came in yesterday, and they had, sorry, I've got my other phone ringing here. They had two packages of treats with them that they got at the little holistic pet store. So they brought them in. They said, what do you think about these treats? I'm training my dog. I need some good treats for him for training. So I looked at the treats, and they're both from these holistic manufacturers. They both come from very good companies. And I started reading the ingredients, and the one that said, like, number one ingredient, salmon, which was great. And then the number two ingredient was maple syrup, which is another way of saying sugar. And then the third ingredient was glycerin, and that's another way of saying sugar. And I said to her, you know, this is very sugary. Let's look at the other one. And we looked at the other one, and that one, same thing. The first ingredient was a protein, like chicken. And then the next ingredient was actually brown sugar. And dogs...
There is brown sugar. It actually said that. Wow.
Brown sugar, yeah. And I think that was Rachel Ray's Nutrish. It was Rachel Ray's Nutrish dog snack. And if you start looking at dog treats at the supermarket, especially, walk into your nearest supermarket and start reading the back of the labels, read Beneful and read a lot, most of the treats, like the Beggin strips and those little bone things, the artificial bone things that come in a package.
And the pepperoni things and all that stuff, right?
Exactly. Those, in my experience as a veterinarian, if you have a dog that comes in that's a diabetic, the chances that they're on one or more of those treats is very, very high. We were at somebody's house one day, and they were babysitting a dog, and they brought up a bag of treats from this dog's owner, and out of six things that they brought over for the dog, they had the dog's food, which the dog's actual food had a form of sugar in it, and then four out of the five treats the dog had actually had sugar in it. And so you need to look for things like sucrose, which is sugar, dextrose, which is sugar, maple syrup, which is sugar. Sometimes they hide it in different ways. They'll say, like, you know, even like agave syrup is still sugar. You know, it's a form of sugar. Sometimes they'll say brown rice syrup, which is sugar. So there's many ways. If you look at the ingredients and you don't know what it is, look it up. And a lot of times you'll find that the ingredients that are kind of masked under certain names are sugar. So that's something to be careful about. And again, the bottom line is that any food that you buy that's in the form of a dry kibble, you know, you're looking at, even if it's got the best ingredients in the world, you're looking at a food that was brought to very high temperatures and cooked in giant fats at high temperatures. A lot of your vitamins get destroyed during that process, even with the very best foods. Then that food is forced through a high-pressure extruder, which puts a ton of pressure into the food and actually does a little more, you know, damage to it. And it takes some of the life out of it, for sure. And then after dry food is popped out of the extruder and made into dry kibble, then it's sprayed with the vitamins. So your vitamins get sprayed on at the end because the processing of the food does do a lot of damage to it. The thing about holistic food is that regular food, regular dog food from the market is preserved usually with some pretty heavy-duty chemicals that we don't really like. On the other hand, when you preserve it with vitamin E and rosemary oil and a lot of the natural things that the natural foods use, your acidity chances go way up. So if you do buy holistic food, it's very important you never have that bag in your house for more than a month. You make sure that you use it up. Don't buy a bag bigger than you can use up in a month because there's an intrinsic reactivity to it. And I learned this actually from some of the guys that had the holistic dog food businesses, and they said, no, after 1 month, our food starts to degrade very rapidly, which it should. If it's got some life in it, you want it to degrade. You don't want it to sit on the counter forever and ever. So.
Absolutely, that's true. On that note, I'm going to put I'm just going to do a little business here and remind people that you're listening to the Whole Scoop Radio on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Carol Ferraci, a licensed registered dietitian and founder of Naturally Nutrition. You can check me out at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. And you're listening tonight to Your Pet, Your Health, Are They Really That Different? With Dr. Constance Di Natale, a doctor of veterinary medicine and holistic health. Doctor, when we were talking, you know, that was really interesting what you said in terms of the holistic food, and I think that's something that most people take for granted, that they're buying it at the store, it's holistic food, so therefore I just have it and it's all fine. Just like the other dog food that's out there that lasts pretty much forever. And just as a practitioner myself, when I'm teaching humans for nutrition, I teach them things like, you know, if it doesn't go bad in a short period of time, then chances are it's not really natural, and you have to kind of look at what you're taking into your body. And if you're not really sure, if you can't pronounce the words, then pretty much it's not natural. Would you agree with that as it relates to the animal food?
Yes, and my rule of thumb for clients is if you can't buy any of the ingredients of what you're looking at, if you can't buy any of those ingredients at a store, like at a regular supermarket, then you might want to think again about buying that food. So a lot of times, even the foods we eat, you flip over the back of the package, you're looking in the ingredient list, and there'll be ingredients that you're not quite sure what they are. You know what they are, but you know you could never buy those in your local supermarket. And I think those are the foods that you really need to look at and think, do I really want to put this in my body if I can't even pick it up locally at my neighborhood store? So, you know, you need to be cautious about that. And then also the fact that, you know, there's a lot of ingredients, again, that people don't quite know what they are or don't see that they're really sugar masked as something else, you know. The other thing I tell people is, in general, why don't you try to feed your dog more things that only have one ingredient? You know, and so instead of going and buying them treats that have 7,000 ingredients, buy a little bit of really good quality meat, cook it up, chop it in little pieces and give them a little tiny piece of meat or a little piece of hard-boiled egg instead of getting these very highly processed sugary treats that we're giving them.
Well, and on that note, as it relates to the food, I mean, if I've heard it once, I've heard it, I don't know, I can't even give you a number. It's just infinite. You know, don't feed your dog anything other than dog food. They shouldn't have it. And we're just talking about just the opposite here. We're not saying no dog food, but we're saying be careful on the ingredients. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think for most people, you know, dog food is really going to be what they're going to do because it's just easy and it's convenient. As far as real food goes, you know, my dogs do get real food. My dogs, and I call that real food because I don't think of dog food as quite real food. My dogs do get 99% homemade food. But I will say that my experience over many years of doing holistic work and having a lot of clients that make their own food, the best diets are homemade and the worst diets are homemade, because a lot of homemade diets are really messed up and people don't make a good balanced diet. And it's always amazing to me that children can eat all this processed food and their parents can buy them all these PB dinners and take them out to McDonald's and they still look relatively healthy for a long time, although inside they're probably getting some heart disease and getting changes in their blood vessels and things. But, you know, for dogs, if you don't feed them correctly for a couple of years, I found that it usually takes about 1.5, 2 years in an adult dog and much, much quicker than that in a puppy. But if you feed them very inappropriately, you are going to start to see changes in the blood work and changes in the dog, how it looks. And I'm talking about cats as well. We're saying dog, but I mean dog and cats. You will see a difference usually within 1.5 to 2 years at the most when you've got a very unbalanced diet for them. I think because they do age quicker than us, you are now accelerating what you see by an inappropriate diet. So homemade diets can be wonderful, but you really need to know what you're doing. You need to supplement well. That being said, I think it's an excellent idea to supplement your regular dog food with real food, with something that's, you know, been alive not too long ago. If you look at the beige kibble in a bag, and I'm not talking about Beneful and some of those foods that are bright red and bright green and have a lot of artificial colors in them, but if you look at most beige dog food and then you look at the ingredients that went into it, that beige dog food, even in a can, doesn't look anything like what those real foods look like. And you know that inherently there's not a lot of life left in there. You know that you wouldn't give that to your grandmother who was feeling very sick and you needed to get her out of a bad disease. You wouldn't think about giving dry dog food to your child and expecting them to grow up healthy and wonderful, although I think for some children it's probably a better idea than what they do eat. So I do think that there are foods that you can add to your dog's diet, cut their food back, don't feed it from the table. I'm not talking about letting them beg at the table. I'm talking about taking some real food, putting it in their bowl at dinner time, you know, a very specific time of the day, cutting their regular food back so they don't get fat, and allowing them to participate in eating a live food and having a little variety in their life so that they don't get problems and don't have as many long-term problems because of the diet that we're giving them.
Great. I think that's very, very sage advice. We're getting a couple of questions on the blog, and I kind of just want to, we're getting some food questions, and then I kind of want to move off the area of food and maybe bounce back to it a little bit. Is it okay if you, are you okay if we take
sure.
a question?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm just going to read these. What types of dishes do you feed your dog in? Are plastics, is a plastic dish? Plastics are a no-no for a dish. Is that correct? So I guess the overall question is it better to use ceramic versus plastic for a dish? That's question number one. Question number two, what about juicing for dogs and what type of items are best? And this is all from one person. Do certain foods cause or add types of behaviors to animals?
I'm not quite sure what she means by behaviors, but we'll start with the bowl. So my favorite bowl is going to be ceramic. I do throw my ceramic bowls away when they crack. I'm having a very hard time finding ceramic bowls that are not made in China. The companies that I use are very careful not to have a lid glaze, but I still get nervous if they get even a little bit of a crack in them that I don't know what's underneath that glaze, so I do throw them away and get a new one. So that is my favorite, is ceramic. Plastic bowls, most plastic does retain bacteria. The fact that you can put tomato sauce in a plastic container and that container will now turn red means that it's permeable. So it's not just permeable to tomato sauce, it's also permeable to bacteria and you know, other microbes that can get in there that you're not going to clean off as easily. Metal bowls are okay. Some animals don't like them, but you know, I think in general, you could probably use a stainless steel bowl that's not terrible. But my favorite is the ceramic. As far as juicing goes, I do have a lot of clients that juice. I think the big thing is for dogs and cats is try to stay away from a lot of fruits. I think most people tend to use too many fruits as well.
And that's because of the sugar, right?
It's because of the sugar. And then also what happens is when any of us do a lot of juicy fruits, and I will tell you which ones are good, but when we use too many tropical fruits in our diet, as you know, because you're a dietitian, but they are very, very high glycemic index. And so when you eat a lot of sugary, wet-type melons and, you know, pretty much my rule is if it drips down your arm when you bite into it, then that's a juicy fruit. It tends to be more of the tropicals, and bananas also fall into this. Those foods are more likely that if you have anything else in your stomach at that time, they're going to cause fermentation. And especially if you do juicing, don't do it with dry dog food, because now the dry dog food takes forever to break down because it's sitting in the stomach, it's dry, it has to be reconstituted, it takes a long time to break down. And I think by adding a juice to that, you're now going to cause fermentation and can make the animal have an upset stomach or even get a little bloaty. Your best things to juice would be your green leafy vegetables. Watch out for too many fruits. If you're going to use fruits, I love pears. I love apples. I would take the skins off of Thin Art Organic because that's where you've got a heavy concentration of pesticides. I like berries, but for animals, you've got to be careful because they're very heavily sprayed, especially strawberries. Strawberries, if they're not organic, I would just keep them for yourself. Because animals are so much smaller than us, a couple of strawberries can really start to add up in chemicals a lot quicker for an animal than for us. And plus, especially for cats, they don't have the liver that we do to break down a lot of toxins. Dogs can break down things pretty good, but I'd still be a little wary. Blueberries are fine, blackberries, raspberries. So I'd stick with more of the berries and with apples and pears. As far as vegetables, I know everybody's big favorite now is kale. But kale is a cruciferous vegetable. It's from the brassica family or cruciferous family. And that whole family, which is also broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, help me out, Carol, just chime in anytime.
Oh, no, you're good. I mean, and that's those
and,
those
the
are
cabbage family, Napa cabbage. But what people love to put in their smoothies the most is kale. And that family, if you use that day after day raw, it's potentially goiterogenic. And animals have so many problems with their thyroids these days that I say if you're going to use kale, fine, but just don't use that family of vegetables every day because that family can affect your thyroid with long-term use, especially in higher amounts. So try to stick more with your mesclun mixes, your spring salad mixes. Dandelion this time of year is wonderful, and a lot of animals really enjoy it. And keep the pulp in. The pulp is fine. Start off small with like a tablespoon, you know, or for a little tiny dog, a teaspoon, and then you can actually add a little bit more if they like it. Give it in the middle of the daytime, room temperature. You should always feed animals and yourselves room temperature. You don't want to eat cold foods because your stomach is meant to work at about 100 degrees. So when you start putting cold things in, you actually stop the enzymatic action of your stomach. When you give your dog cold things to eat or feed them cold out of the refrigerator, then you are affecting the enzymes that help them to break down their stomach acids. So, their enzymes that break down their food.
Yeah, and that's true for people too. So, again, another similarity. Did we answer all of those questions?
Yes, you want to know.
No, we've got the behavior question. Do certain foods cause...
Oh.
Yeah.
I think most of the behavior issues I see from food, you see behavior issues from food typically when the animal's not tolerating it well, like it's just not the correct food for them. So some animals will get lethargic with a food that they're intolerant to, just like humans. Like, you know, some people eat wheat and they get sleepy afterwards. So again, like humans, sometimes if you give little animals, a lot of people think that their little animals get low blood sugar, and so they'll give them something really sweet and sugary, and then they'll crash later, just like a human will. So I think those things can affect them behaviorally. Some cats, when they're allergic to their food, will shred themselves, and they'll they can actually have a condition called hyperesthesia, where they'll start licking the air, they'll lick the ground, they'll lick the carpet. And hyperesthesia is when they get an extreme hypersensitivity in the nerves, usually of their spine. So some cats, when they eat foods that don't agree with them, that's what the side effect is they get this horrible neurological condition where they can get hyperesthesia. There's other reasons why they get it too, but that's one of them is a food allergy. Or they can self-mutilate. A lot of cats that self-mutilate themselves have food intolerances. I'm hoping that's what you meant by behavioral changes, but I'm not sure.
I just got a clarification from that person, and she was looking for possible ADHD behavior.
And it's caused from the food, possibly.
She's asking, is it possible? I think she's, I don't know, she didn't go into specifics. I'm assuming she's got a hyperactive animal of some sort. I don't know. If you want to clarify that, log back in, okay?
If it's a young animal and they start to do repetitive behavior that seems like you can't stop them, like say you feed it a very young puppy, you know, or middle-aged puppy, you give them you feed them their dinner, and then afterwards they maybe start doing like a typical OCD behavior where they'll get up, they'll walk in a circle and come back, get up, walk in a circle and come back. When you see things like that, that can be indicative of a liver shunt. And sometimes that'll even show up in older animals. And with a liver shunt, if you eat food with protein in it, you'll cause a mild encephalitis, and then the animal can actually either get aggressive or get hyper or can start to have OCD behavior, which can sometimes be diagnostic. Not diagnostic, but it can be indicative, and then you go and check and see if you've got liver shunt. Sometimes food allergies, just like children, will cause animals to have strange behavior. So, right, if you've got a correlation that every time I feed them, you know, this weird behavior happens, or when I feed them a very specific food, you know, if that was the case, I would change the food completely to something different, feed them that for a few days, then go back to that first food and see if you can replicate the behavior only when you feed a certain food. But you'd need to change your carbs and protein during the test period to something you think would not bother the animal in order to be able to test that hypothesis.
Well, if I can interject a little bit, when I'm talking to, you know, just my own clients, when I do things like that with them, I always have them journal it. I always have them write it down so that they can keep track of what they're doing and make sure that, you know, those variables are either included or eliminated depending on what we're looking at. But so it might be helpful if you're really trying to find something that's going on with possible food, then make sure you keep track of what you're giving. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, totally. We do a lot of food trials in our clinic, and when we do, I make a very strong point that you've got to keep a food journal, because I've had people years ago where, you know, if they came in with an inflammatory bowel animal and I'd put them on a very specific food trial, and then we reintroduce things at a certain time, and you know, and I remember having a woman say to me, you know, well, he never did get the inflammatory bowel signs back during this entire process, but halfway through he got this raging ear infection. And I said, oh, my gosh, what food did you feed? That's what the problem food is. You know, so sometimes she'll get this exacerbation, and she had no idea what the food was because she didn't keep track. So now I'm very, very adamant, keep track always when you experiment, because you do forget, you know. And I have people that go through the whole process and 2 years later forget, and they're back to feeding the same thing, and I've got it written in my record, and I'm like, no, remember, you can't feed that. That's a bad food. And they forget. So.
Yeah, they forget. Okay. You know, I kind of want to shift gears here a little bit, because I want to talk about I really do want to talk about the subtle similarities between the human and the animal in terms of what – you know, kinds of things that we're seeing. But I really, you touched on this earlier about the inflammatory process and about what we're seeing with animals. And, you know, we talked a little bit of, you know, about that, but I think I want to explore that a little bit more. And I want to talk about how that's the incident rate is climbing,
But also, I kind of want to bring it back to the kinds of things that you're doing in terms of the modalities that you use to kind of counteract what we're seeing in the animal population. And I know we're not talking about the human population, but I am seeing similar modalities in the human population is kind of leveling off that internal inflammatory response. And I think that we should talk about that. Like, for instance, let's just start with what is traditional Chinese medicine and how does that relate to what we're seeing and not necessarily relate, but how does it influence in a positive way or not so positive in terms of when is it time to use traditional Chinese medicine versus traditional medicine and what is it and why is it so beneficial?
Well, Carol, I think, Western medicine has its huge benefits over some of the more holistic things that we do. So, for example, regular medicine is hands down amazing when it comes to you having an emergency. The drugs that we have, like antibiotics and steroids, are phenomenal. If your animal is in shock, has been hit by a car, needs 911, surgery is phenomenal. I think surgery and drugs have filled in a couple of gaps in traditional medicine where there was some more failures. Diagnostics, phenomenal to use regular medicine. Our current medicine for diagnostics is amazing. Blood work and, MRIs, those things are fabulous. I have studied traditional Chinese veterinary medicine for many years, and that comes into play for my practice from the time animals are babies, because we actually start to implement that with puppies, because Chinese medicine is focused on the individual. And so it's focused on not herd medicine, like all these dogs should all be fed Iams dog food from the time they're puppies and then feed Iams adult when they're older. Chinese medicine more says, like, well, this animal has this specific personality. This animal, just like humans, if you've got a specific personality, if you've got, a specific way that you are, you've got propensities towards certain disharmonies in your body, your chances of having specific diseases may increase because of who you are and who you were born as. And therefore, what can we do now when you're young to try to prevent this? Chinese medicine should always be about prevention. That's where people used to get paid. The barefoot doctors would go to the villages, and he got paid when nobody got sick. And if people under his watch were getting sick, he didn't get paid. So imagine that if you only paid your veterinarian when your animal, didn't get sick. And if he was sick, you didn't have to pay him.
Well, I think we could really apply that to our basic healthcare system as well, but that's a topic for another show.
Absolutely. So with Chinese medicine, what I typically see now is that animals will come in, dogs or cats, that will have some kind of a chronic problem, autoimmune disease, they've got arthritis, they've got kidney failure, chronic kidney disease, they've got cancer, they've got chronic hepatitis. So there's so many different things, chronic ear infections, chronic skin infections, chronic bladder infections, and the key word behind all of this is chronic. So a lot of people find their way to my office because they've been to the vet for years for the same thing, and they're just tired of that paradigm and want to find a new way to approach things in a more holistic way. And how Chinese, and I do a lot of different type of modalities, but specifically you're asking Chinese medicine, if they come in and
interject whatever you like. I just use that as an example. So go ahead.
Sure. So, if we're going to use traditional Chinese medicine, what we're going to do is do some acupuncture, which for animals that are in pain, it helps them with pain. For animals that have areas of their body with poor circulation, it can help with the circulation. For dogs with autoimmune disease, it can help to put the immune system back into right again, so that they have less reliance on drugs. For animals that have behavioral issues and psychoses, acupuncture can be so calming and so regulating and get the animal back in harmony with itself. And then also, we use herbal medicine, and the herbs can augment our treatment. Or for animals that don't like acupuncture, can actually be a big part of the treatment. But again, the number one thing Chinese medicine teaches us is the thing that goes in your body every single day is your food. And if your food is wrong, you know, I have clients that come in, they feed terrible diets. I've got them on herbs. The animal's doing great. And they say, well, how long do I have to keep coming in and doing acupuncture and herbs? And I say, as long as you keep having that bad diet of yours, you know, because I'm having to use those to try to counteract, you know, what that diet's doing to your dog, you know. And obviously that diet wasn't working because now your dog got cancer and now your dog had some terrible thing happen to it. So now, you know, we're going to try to reverse that. But as long as we don't change the diet, then you're going to rely heavily on other modalities like this. So,
okay. I'm going to interject for a second here, remind everybody that you're listening to the Whole Scoop Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. We're talking tonight, your pet, your health, are they really that different, with Dr. Constance DiNatale? We've got quite a few callers on the board that we're going to be taking questions in a few minutes, but if you do have a question, please remember to press 1. Not seeing too many people that have pressed 1. I'm not sure if you've called in just to listen, which is wonderful, but if you're calling in with a question, remember to press 1. There you go. We got a few. we can take a couple of questions now if you like, or we can talk a little bit more about some of these other things. Are you good with some questions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Let's look at, let me see, I'm going to see who's on the phone, who's been on the phone the longest. I'm going to start with the longest because we got quite a few here. Let's see. Caller 4585.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Got a couple questions. Changing the diet and going to... how would you get an animal to start eating vegetables? They're not going to go to it. And another question I had is about garlic and seasonings, herbs. I mean, where do I start?
Got it.
Okay,
thank you. So as far as feeding vegetables go, how do you get your animal to eat more vegetables? And if you look at most dog foods, most commercial dog foods now are about 75% carbohydrates as it is, you know, meaning vegetable. There's a little bit of vegetables in dog food as well as a lot of grains, or if you get grain-free, then there's also a lot of still refined carbohydrates. And remind me, Carol, we'll talk at some point a little bit about grain-free. I think that's an important topic, but I know we're not going to just beat the dead horse on food for too long. But you don't necessarily want animals to eat a lot more vegetables. So if I had to say, what can you add to their food that would give them the most benefit, I would say focus a little more on protein and then chop up some vegetables really fine and mix them in with that protein. A lot of animals love vegetables. A lot of Shih Tzus and a lot of, you know, Labradors will eat vegetables all day long. A lot of people like to give their dogs raw carrots. But as far as giving them good, nutritious vegetables like the spring salad mixes, you can actually do that with the salad dressing, but you've got to chop it up really fine. Animals, most dogs and all cats do not have the enzymes in their saliva to break down vegetables. They don't have the molars that we have to grind vegetables up. So you really need to take the vegetables and cook them very well so that you break down the cell wall, or you need to grind them, you know, take a knife and chop them up fine. And then mix it, you know, and don't do this all at once. You'll get a diarrhea animal, but, you know, you give them diarrhea. But you just mix a little bit of vegetable, like a half a teaspoon or a teaspoon if it's a smaller dog, with a couple of teaspoons of a little protein, like a little leftover meat, a little leftover fish is great. Throw a sardine in. Sardines are wonderful, loaded with omega-3. A little bit of salmon, get some canned salmon and throw a little spoonful. And just give them a little bit of that mixed with the vegetable, they'll eat it up fine. You know, a little bit of sweet potato with protein. But I think that protein is key. We don't want to start adding a lot more vegetables and carbohydrates to our commercial food because then we start to have some problems with imbalance. We're already at the edge of having too much carbohydrates in their food as it is. Early on, dogs' food and cats' food used to be, well, not so much cats because that's still pretty high in protein, but dog food used to be much, much higher in protein back in the day. And now it's much, much lower. because it was just, it's an expensive thing to feed protein. So I think focus on feeding a little more protein, add the vegetables in with that, mix it in well, and I think you'll have no problem with that. As far as seasonings, fresh garlic is fine. For a tiny dog, I'd add like maybe the equivalent of a slice of garlic. For a bigger dog, maybe a quarter of a clove, you know, a small clove. You don't want to add lots of garlic. A little bit of garlic can help on some dogs for preventing fleas, not for all dogs. It just works on a few dogs. You don't want to do garlic salt. You don't want to do onion salt. You don't want to use garlic powder. You don't want to use onion powder. Those actually are too concentrated, and you tend to have a possibility of some blood problems if you do that, and it can affect the red cells. Not fresh garlic in small amounts. You can use any other seasoning. You can put a little oregano, little parsley is fine. Animals don't tend to love it, but you can use seasonings like that, no problem. Whenever I cook my dog food, I always throw in some thyme, I throw in some bay leaves, I throw in whatever I would do if I was cooking my own. Seasonings always help us. Spices and herbs always help us to digest our food better. That's why we have them in our diet. So you can add it into the dog food. Use much less. Their sense of smell is much greater than ours, so you need much less than you would for yourself for them to appreciate it and also for their system to react to it. Okay, Carol.
Great. Thank you very much.
About the protein, is that cooked or uncooked meats?
I would start any animal with uncooked, and then it really depends on the individual animal whether you'd go with raw or not. Some animals can do okay on raw, and some animals are not made for raw. So you kind of start with cooked and go from there. You know, and you could probably get some guidance from your regular vet about, you know, if you wanted to switch over to some raw. But I don't ever start animals on raw food because they're just not used to it, and your system pushes it through a little too quickly. So cooked food will take a little bit longer to process than the fresh, easier on the system. And, you know, maybe sometime. Okay.
All right.
Thanks for calling
in.
You're welcome.
Okay. We're going to move to the next caller. Caller 9417. 9417, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Midge, Carol.
Hey, how are you?
How are you doing?
I'm good. So, do you have a question
hey,
for us?
I just got a question for you and for the vet. We have a 9-year-old golden retriever, Ruby, and she has a nasal tumor. And she had a real bad nosebleed on Monday. We had to take her to the local vet hospital because our vet wasn't in, and they stopped the nosebleed.
Good.
And they gave us this medicine. EPINEPHRINE. They put that up her nose, and they said if she has it again, you know, for us to, if we can't stop it, to give it to her. Put a couple drops up her nostrils.
Yes.
And then I got a question for the vet out there told us to get this medicine. It's from your kind of vet. It's called YUNNANPAIOYAO.
Yes.
And she said that would stop it. So we were a little bit, you know, hesitant about it. So I thought I would call and see what you had to say.
Yeah. The herb you're talking about, what your vet gave you is epinephrine. And epinephrine is the same thing that they use for people that have bee stings. And, you know, if you have an allergic reaction to a bee sting, and go into anaphylaxis, you take an epinephrine shot. So that's what they gave you, and when you give epinephrine, it can, you know, it can squeeze down the blood vessels in the nose and stop the bleeding. The herb that you're talking about is Uninbayao. Uninbayao has been around for, you know, probably well over 100 years. It's made down in Sichuan. It's made in Sichuan province in China, and It was made originally for martial artists who would, you know, rupture their spleens and break each other's bones and really damage each other very heavily. So Yunin is wonderful if you're either having bad bleeding, or oppositely, it's wonderful if you've got severe bruising. So, and we use it for any dog who's got a bleeding tumor, always goes home with a couple of boxes of it, always. because it's very, very important. So if you go and get the Yunin for a golden retriever, you know, Ruby, I'm assuming, is probably about 50, 60 pounds. And what you would do is you get the Yunin, and if she's having a really, if she's having a really bad bleed, you'll note that either in the very center of the package or on one of the ends, there's going to be a small red pill, and then the rest of the package is orange capsules. So if you're having a really scary bleed where you're like, oh, my gosh, then you pop out the tiny little red pill, and then I would take three of those capsules, and you put it in a nice piece of food that she likes, and you have her eat it. You can do your epinephrine as well, but it'll stop it from bleeding after the epinephrine as well. And so you can give her that, and then you wait, and if the bleeding stops being great, but if it's still trickling in a couple of hours, maybe pop her two more. If she tends to bleed frequently, a lot of veterinarians then will have you give it every day a couple of times a day. But it is fine to give. I would also pursue, if I were you, I don't know what else you're doing to treat it, but you could probably find a Chinese practitioner, you know, a veterinarian that practices Chinese medicine in your area that could actually help you do a little bit more than just use that herb, because that herb's going to stop bleeding. It might shrink your tumor back a little bit, but it's not going to actually have a huge effect getting rid of it, where there's other Chinese herbs that actually might help you a lot to help get rid of that if you're not going to treat it any other way.
Okay, well, they got her on prednisone right now.
Right, but that's not going to do, that's not doing a darn thing for your tumor. So
it's not.
No.
What do you,
it'll take down the inflammation in her nose, but I think Carol's going to tell you later on in the show some websites that you can go on to find somebody in your area that can practice.
You can just do that now. We'll just give that now. The AHBMA.org.
Yeah. And actually for her, I think her best bet might be the TCBM.com one. That one might be a little better for what she's got going on.
Okay.
TCBM.org is a good one.
It's com.
I'm sorry. TCBM.com. And I'll give them out when we're done. We'll give them out before that we actually end the show. And it's a great way of finding someone like Dr. DeNatale. So, in your area.
Yeah, because her eye was swollen, and they did give her meds for that, and it took it down. Her eye was swollen, and then we didn't have x-rays or anything because we didn't want to. We put her through it, and they said it really wouldn't help her. So then when we found out about you, we thought, well, we're going to call and see what you have to say.
Yeah.
So if I go on this one, then I can just see what they say.
What area are you in? I would go on the TCDM.com, and then you put in your zip code, and you find somebody practicing. It's people that are trained in Chinese herbs and Chinese medicine. Find somebody close to you, and then maybe go visit them and see if there's something they might be able to help you with, be able to help you use that herb better, too. The Unibio, it's nice if you have somebody helping you to use it, because you should be on some other stuff with it, ideally. You know, and they can help you get a better diet, too, you know, because sometimes diet will help you.
Dog food. That's what we've been feeding her for since she was a puppy, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
So, maybe check out that website.
Okay, because the vet out there at the hospital, she said we might need a prescription for this drug, and she said she'd be glad to write it.
It's not prescription.
I think what we'll do is, we can give out that website to help you with that, and then the other thing that we can do is maybe we'll do a follow-up show to kind of give everybody a little more information, because we just can't get to everything tonight, and we're almost out of time.
Okay.
She needs some quick help with that, too.
And we've got another blog question, so I'm gonna say thank you. I appreciate you calling in, and we are going to take a blog question right now, okay?
Hey,
good luck
thank
with Ruby.
You both.
Good
you.
Luck
thank
with Ruby.
The blog question is, I have had my dog to two different acupuncturists. The first time, I saw no difference. I went back three more times after that, and I decided there was no change. But a couple of months later, a friend of mine referred me to someone else, and there's been a tremendous difference. So how do I evaluate good versus bad? What kind of questions should I ask when I'm looking for someone like you?
Well, I think, you know, with any practitioner, you know, I have friends that go to the chiropractor, you know, and this is the same with lots of people, where, you know, I've had friends that go to a chiropractor, they get phenomenal results. I go and I go and I go and I go, and I really just don't, it didn't work for me. And then some acupuncturists are better than others. So it's not necessarily that it didn't work because the vet's not good, but it could be. You know, so sometimes, you know, it's important to ask how long have you been doing this. But then again, I've had students that have come into me that they're still learning acupuncture and they're already phenomenal. I do a lot of internships in my clinic. I've done hundreds of them with veterinarians that are just learning acupuncture. And some of them just come in and they just wow me, you know, and they're just learning. They haven't even finished the course yet. And they're fantastic. You know, and then I see other people that have been practicing for years and, you know, they're just, their heart's not in it. So I think it helps if you go to somebody who's either been doing it for a while or, you know, if you're lucky, maybe you've got somebody in your area that, you know, has been referred by a friend or has just, you know, you doing this as their sole way of making a living as a veterinarian. Sometimes regular vets also do acupuncture and can be wonderful at it. But, you know, I think your best way is word of mouth, number one. And the other thing is that I think you did correctly that if you're not seeing a big difference within three or four treatments, then I think it's probably time to bail and go someplace else. Because a lot of times acupuncture does not help a lot of animals until you've had at least three or four treatments. So we do tell people that when they call. We're like, please give at least, you know, four, maybe even six treatments before you decide that it doesn't work for you. And most animals, the vast majority, within the first three treatments, you should at least start to get an inkling that it's going to do something better. So it's just like any practitioner, you know, sometimes it's a good match, sometimes it's not. Experience does help. How often is that veterinarian actually doing that modality in their clinic? Do they do a lot of acupuncture? Or are they just kind of doing it once or twice a week? You know, I've got friends of mine that maybe do one or two acupunctures a week at their clinic. So, you know, I think the more that they're doing, the better they're going to get at it. And sometimes it's just a matter of it just didn't resonate with that particular person, you know, and you just needed to go to somebody else.
Right. I think that makes sense, too. I mean, sometimes there's just a connection with someone and you can tell the difference. So that's all great advice. We've got one more blog question, and then I want you – we're almost out of time, so we've got to kind of make this really fast. Should animals be treated when sick like ourselves, like the BRAT diet? Are you familiar with the BRAT, which is the rice and applesauce and all of that? I mean, it's just a very, very bland kind of situation. Would, you know, go ahead.
When animals are sick, I usually tell people feed them beige things. So, you know, I feed them foods that don't have a lot of color because those tend to be easiest on your stomach. So when you get sick, you don't think, oh, I think I'll go have hamburger right now. Usually chicken soup, you know, which is going to be rice or a little bit of pasta and some chicken that's well cooked, you know, to distraction. So I think it's the same with animals is cook a little bit of carbohydrate that's beigey, like, you know, even white rice. This is one of the few times I'll say do white rice. Because it's so easy to digest, it's in and out of the system quick. And then you can do a little bit of chicken, and then once in a while I do ground beef. Especially if I know the animal doesn't do well on chicken, you can do a little ground beef too, and then drain the fat out of it. But definitely.
Okay. And like I said, we're almost out of time, and you wanted me to get back to grain free. Maybe you can do that in a split second or two, and see where.
Sure.
What you wanted to say about grain-free?
Sure. Grain-free, the one thing I wanted to say is that is the new darling of the holistic world is everyone's like, oh, your dog has to be grain-free,
if you read the labels on the grain-free dog food, what they replace the grains with is potato and tapioca starch. And those are both very high glycemic index foods, not necessarily any healthier than grains. So it's not that I'm saying, oh, grains are so great, which I really don't have a huge problem with grains for animals necessarily. Some animals I don't feed it to them. But watch your foods, because to replace it with potatoes and tapioca, it's maybe not all that much of an improvement, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Dr. DiNatale, thank you so very much for joining us. I want to let everybody know that our next show will be on June 11th, where we're going to be talking about dry needling and acupuncture. So we're doing a little more with acupuncture, only on the human side this time. We're going to talk about which one is right for you, because one is maybe covered a little differently with insurance versus the other, and who's doing it, and there's just a whole lot of a hot topic to talk about. And we're going to have Dr. Kathleen Levy. She's an acupuncturist, a doctor of acupuncture and oriental medicine, and Dr. Scott Barnett, who's a doctor of acupuncture and a physical therapist. So it should be a very interesting show. That's on June 11th at 7 p.m. Remember, this is Blog Talk Radio, The Whole Scoop. Dr. DiNatale, thank you so very much. I'm wondering if we could do a follow-up show at some point.
Sure, we should do that.
We've got so many. We didn't get to a whole lot of things tonight, but we've covered an awful lot, and it's been fabulous. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much, Cheryl.
We're going to say goodnight to everybody. Thank you, and we'll see you next time. Good night.
Good night.